everyone, and welcome to GradCast from Syracuse University. My name is Glenn Wright. My guest today is Dr. Leo Lambert, who is President Emeritus of Elon University in North Carolina. He has a national reputation for the remarkable efflorescence that Elon experienced under his leadership, with a heavy emphasis on the direct personal student experience. Well before his time at Elon, though, he was the lead administrator at the graduate school here at Syracuse, where he was instrumental in creating the TA program with its monstrous and, for the time, path-breaking TA orientation program, and also the future professoriate program, the FPP, which I currently administer and which is about to celebrate its 30th anniversary. Dr. Lambert will be the featured speaker at the FPP kickoff event on September 15th, 2023. For you FPP participants, that'll be 2:45 p.m. in Lyman Hall 132. It's my pleasure to welcome to GradCast Dr. Leo Lambert.
Thank you, Glenn. It's a pleasure to be with you. Lots of fond memories of the graduate school and Syracuse University.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that, but I want to start with your more recent history at Elon, where you were in the president's seat for almost two decades, 1999 to 2018. And during that time, it rose from perhaps relative obscurity to having a national reputation as a great place to be an undergrad student. And in fact, in the past academic year, garnered the number one ranking from U.S. News and World Report for undergrad teaching, which is pretty cool. I'm curious, how did you approach that transformation, and what do you think were the keys to its success?
Well, Elon's a remarkable community filled with incredible people that are so devoted to the place. And that, of course, I think always is number one. But I think there are a couple of other keys that are worth mentioning, Glenn. The first is, I think Elon has this ethos about the place, about keeping the question, what is best for students and learning, at the very heart of every major decision that we make at this institution. And higher education institutions don't always do that. I mean, we are more naturally sometimes chase prestige or are concerned about the bottom line or the performance of the athletic program or are asking what's best for faculty and staff. And those are all very important things as well, and they all overlap. But this big question, I think, needs to be infused in every decision the institution is making. Even, I'll give you a quick example, even campus architecture. If you come onto Elon's campus, you know, when we work with our architects, we're talking about architecture has to reflect student engagement. We want to make sure there are lots of places for students to gather and work in small groups and individually right near where the faculty are. So that architecture reflects the relationship building emphasis of the campus. So that question is all critical. The other big thing, I think, is that Elon has had a relentless focus for three decades on strategic planning with a 10-year time horizon, and then even more importantly, actually executing those plans. In higher ed, where strategic planning gets a bad name is everybody makes up a plan, but then nobody does it. And we've gotten good at defining some really hard stretch goals that are going to challenge the entire institutional community to meet and then getting them done. You know, my first big strategic plan here at Elon, you know, we decided what we wanted to shelter Chapter Phi Beta Kappa. Well, that's hard to do. I mean, that's Phi Beta Kappa says, we want to come onto your campus and sense excellence everywhere. Well, we hadn't had a foreign language requirement in place for 35 years. We had a brand new library, but kind of crummy print and digital collections. And we had to make 10 years of very focused investments. We were turned down twice by Phi Beta Kappa. Second time they said, They wrote us a very encouraging letter and said, you guys are doing all the right things. We're following Elon. Keep it up. You know, they were kind of our cheerleaders and saw the hard work that we were doing. And the third time was the charm. And the same for our business school. When I came to Elon, we had an unaccredited business school. We did not have AACSB accreditation. Our business school was in the former student, tiny little student union building. And so we set accreditation as our goal and a brand new building for the business school. And that's 10 years of hard work. And then when we're done with that for the next strategic plan, we said, we want a top business school. And I remember in those strategic planning meetings, the board was and faculty are going back and forth about, is it top 50? Is it top 75? And, you know, we had to put our big boy, big girl pants on and say, no, it's going to be top 50. And you know, Wharton and Harvard and Stanford aren't going anywhere. So we knew that was going to be a big claw to get there. But again, it's sort of this, okay, let's break this down into parts and figure out what needs to be done. A lot of it was very student-focused work. You know, how can we have world-class internship programs for our students? Are we getting them placed in the best places, in the most important cities in the country and around the world? And you just have to stay the course. In higher ed, you see a lot of let's go chase the new shiny thing, you know, whether it's AI or, you know, TQM back when I was total quality management, yeah. When I was at Syracuse was a big thing. Everybody yeah. was into total quality management. We're just trying to focus on big, important things and stay the course. And it's amazing how quickly 10 years goes by. I mean, you know, 10 years goes by in the blink of an eye. Yep. And why you have to be relentlessly focused.
Yeah. So you were talking about the architecture and kind of that as a reflection of the student experience or the desired student experience. And so I took a look in preparing for this at your webpage on the Elon site. And it mentions that during your tenure as president, that the physical infrastructure just grew exponentially. It says 100 buildings and 4 residential neighborhoods were added. And when I saw that, I just thought, okay, there must have been like a really intense capital campaign to make that happen. And of course, fundraising is a big part of any college president's job. But I think there's also kind of a perception among some in higher ed, let's say a lot of faculty members, for instance, who kind of see, you know, chasing the money as kind of inversely related to the investment in the students and the quality of the academics. And I'm wondering from your standpoint, having spent all this time in the president's chair, what you see as kind of the relationship of money in higher ed and kind of negotiating that, keeping it on path so that it actually serves your purposes instead of becoming a purpose unto itself?
Ah, it's a great question. Well, of course, money is all important, right? I mean, it funds the things that we care about the most, need-based aid for students, professorships for faculty. These new buildings, critical investments year after year in experiential learning and engaged learning, which is Elon's brand. And we're, you know, ranked U.S. News and World Report top 100 university right now. I guarantee you we're probably the only or one of the very few institutions on that list without a $1 billion endowment. So we need to be very smart about how we spend our money. Again, focused on the most important thing. So I think what leaders need to do is a couple of things. One of which is it is a responsibility of the president of the institution to keep his or her finger on the pulse of the institution. If I learned one lesson about the college presidency or university presidency in 20 years is that leadership is the stewardship of culture. And if you screw up the culture, you screwed up everything, right? So you have to know your faculty, you have to know your staff, you have to know your students. And you need to balance that with not being there more than half the time, because the presidency, the modern presidency, does require you to be where donors are and, you know, to be participating in the NCAA and doing, being the places, representing the school, being the face of the institution, wherever you need to be around the country and the world. So it takes a lot of planning. A calendar needs to be planned out 6 months to a year ahead of time so that you're plugging in the places on campus where you absolutely need to be. We have monthly faculty meetings during the academic year. It's kind of a holdover from being a small college, but it's part of our culture. I hardly ever missed a faculty meeting or an academic council meeting, which is our kind of equivalent of a faculty senate. And I, you know, regularly, my chief of staff, vice president for student life, would plug in events where I would be connected with students. And so it just, you have to do both. I mean, you have to be gone and you have to be present. And that takes just good old fashioned planning. I had two great chiefs of staff, one of whom is now a college president. The other is a vice president for enrollment and student engagement at Bucknell. Very smart, great leaders. Lisa Keegan and Jeff Stein are their names. And I would always say to them, your job is to live my life before I live it. Go figure it out. Get this all figured out. And part of the, you know, a big part of the chief of staff's job at Elon is managing that calendar. So you're creating this reality of not being there half the time and the illusion that you're there a lot.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
it's as simple as that.
Now, so in addition to all that physical infrastructure, you also started up a law school, I guess, 2006,
yes.
And
yes.
A School of Health Sciences, 2011. You mentioned really beefing up the law program as well. And so I think my impression is that you were kind of ahead of the curve with some of those efforts. I mean, now you can't kick a rock without hitting a liberal arts college that is adding professional master's programs, or in some cases, even doctoral degrees, presumably in most cases as kind of a survival strategy, revenue generator. But again, kind of like the money issue, there are some detractors to that approach, and not just faculty, but let's say alumni in many cases, kind of looking at that and saying, you know, the mission is shifting now. It's not the place that I loved and remember. Whereas it seems like the opposite happened at Elon, where you were indeed able to create that the kind of student-centered culture that you wanted at the same time that you're adding these more professionally focused programs, which in many cases are where the graduate population seems to mostly reside. Elon has, I think, a relatively small grad population, but still kind of harbored in those relatively recent, more professionally focused schools and colleges. So how did you thread that needle in terms of expanding the scope of the academic offerings, but also kind of creating that student culture that you wanted?
Well, I think you have to start with the big question of mission and institutional identity. And ours is that of a liberal arts university. We're not a liberal arts college. We're not like Middlebury. We have, you know, graduate programs and six schools. We're a place where the heart of the undergraduate experience is very much still the liberal arts. And our professional school deans in education and business and communications, health sciences, and so forth, are some of the most fierce advocates for the and best spokespeople for why liberal arts education is so important. If you're a student in our School of Communications, you know, the comm school will let you take fewer classes in communications if you do a double major in arts and sciences, because they think you're going to be a better journalist if you have both a journalism degree and an engineering degree or a science degree in, you know, biology or physics or what have you.
Uh-huh.
So and our students are choosing the most amazing combinations of majors and minors when you create that kind of environment that where they don't see it as the way higher education oftentimes frames it, which is the liberal arts versus the profession. It's really both. So I was interviewing a student for a top award one time. She had a double major in accounting and classics. And I said, that is so interesting. Well, tell me about that. And she said, well, you know, I want to be an accounting major, an accountant for a big, you know, a big firm, public accounting firm. But she said, you know, just classics, I think, helps me. A good grounding in the humanities has been so important for me to really understanding organizational culture, which is a big part of what you need to understand when you're going into these big companies week after week and doing their audit work.
Yeah.
And then she said, and then I'm going to add to that, I'm going to do my internship in Ireland because I also want to get an international perspective on this. Well, when you create the kind of environment that is both and rather than either or, that's what students will put together. And it's mm-hmm. wonderful and it's fascinating. And I think you have to, these days, especially, we need to talk about the liberal arts and sciences in the current culture that we have in this country and explain how enduring and important and foundational the skills and dispositions that the liberal arts bring to the undergraduate experience. You can't assume that,
yeah.
But students get it. And our liberal arts program is, we have the same Elon Core curriculum for every undergraduate student, no matter what school or college you're in. And it's at least half of the curriculum. So
okay.
it's a pretty big part of essential part of,
yeah.
of what we do at the undergraduate experience at Elon.
Yeah. So I'm curious now. So since you stepped down as president, you've been doing a lot of stuff, including writing books. You have a couple of books out recently, co-written with Peter Felton, who's also at Elon, Relationship Rich Education, How Human Relationships Drive Success in College from 2020. And then just this year, Connections Are Everything, A College Student's Guide to Relationship Rich Education. Could you talk a little bit about that concept of relationship rich education and how you see that as kind of central to what you want in terms of the transformative impact of college on students?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, we've known for almost 50 years, thanks to great people like Sandy Astin and at Syracuse, Vince Tinto, who's, you know, legendary faculty member in the School of Education, that student relationships with faculty and peers and staff influence learning and happiness and identity and motivation and well-being and graduation rates and even postgraduate and career outcomes. And more recent scholarship tells us that this is doubly so for students of color and first generation college students. These connections are critical.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not, I think, oftentimes transparent enough, particularly for first generation students, in helping students understand that and helping them develop the strategies to make connections that are going to be so important to them through college and after college. There was a study done by Gallup Purdue. I'm sure you remember it 9 years ago. And one of the big headlines was that if students had a faculty member who, one, cared about them as a person, and I would say this applies to teaching assistants too, by the way,
mm-hmm.
Made them excited about learning, and three, encouraged them to pursue their dreams, their odds of being engaged at work following graduation almost doubled.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense when you think about it. If you're engaged at university, you're going to bring your engaged self when you show up at work, right?
Yeah.
But the sad part of that headline was that only 14% of college students in this 60,000 student sample reported experiencing all three of those things.
Mm-hmm.
We can do better. And I think, you know, relationship-rich education, I was told recently, has been one of Johns Hopkins' 10 best-selling books of all time. And so it's hit a chord. And I think the reason it's done so is, you know, the pandemic hit us.
Yeah.
Spontaneity of college campuses was lost. The nature of students, who students are on university campuses today, it's not the same as it was 10 or 15 years ago.
We have many trying more, to foster connection, like a pandemic is not a great context.
Not helpful at all. And so I think what I am seeing happening at all kinds of institutions that Peter and I travel quite a bit is there's this sort of recentering of institutional commitment to human connections and relationships as the heartbeat of what higher education should be all about. And I think if we don't do this, yep, we're making a big mistake, because it is so critical to every dimension of student success and well-being. And I don't need to tell you that student health and mental health is another big topic on campus these days, one of which is highly related to the quality of personal relationships students experience.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And mental health issues with graduate students, even kind of another, you know, ratcheting up another level in terms of the impact kind of across the board. I want to make sure, Leo, that we get a chance to talk about your time at Syracuse. So you were a doctoral student in education in the 80s and then transitioned into an administrative role with the graduate school. I think your title was associate dean, but as I recall, I mean, I wasn't around then, but in my research that was kind of a transitional time for the graduate school. So it was really you, as I understand it, pretty much running the show. How did that transition work and kind of set you on the path that your subsequent career has taken?
Well, I was sort of enlisted to get the TA program off the ground as a volunteer. Ron Kavanaugh, who was vice president for undergraduate studies at the time, and Karen Hiemai, who was vice president for research and graduate studies, two dynamic forces on the campus, tapped a couple of people, me included, to sort of, all right, get this off the ground. And by the way, it needs to be done by August. So, I mean, we worked our tails off. I have since rediscovered the joy of summer because in you didn't, with the TA program, you didn't have summer. Summer was like the beginning of June. And then it was all getting ready for TA orientation. But there was, we just felt, so I did this as a volunteer, and then they created this associate dean position. I applied for it, was hired, and then we got a good base in professional development for graduate students with a teaching assistant orientation program, and then added to that the work, the bigger work with the Future Professoriate Project, as we called it then. I think it's a program now. Mm-hmm. So you asked about recollection. So I've been thinking about this, and what do I remember most vividly? One of which, I think at the top of my list, was the pure joy of working with teaching fellows. At least we called them teaching fellows then. I think you have a new title for them now.
Yeah, teaching mentors. They didn't like the word fellows because a fellowship is you're not getting paid to do work, right? Like, so they made us change it to teaching mentors.
Well, anyway, these teaching fellows, teaching mentors were the heart of TA orientation. And you talk about relationship building. I mean, they were the essence of modeling good practices and good behavior and just a joy to work with. We had 24 of them every year, and we just had such good people. And then I recall also, we used to, when we were launching the Future Professoriate Project, every summer we would take a busload or two of faculty up to Meadowbrook for the faculty teaching mentors conference. And there was this sort of excitement about, we're doing something countercultural in graduate education. We're talking about students having both mentoring in teaching as well as in scholarship and research. And that was a wonderful group of faculty that, Jerry Clark in performing arts, and Jerry Avinsky in economics. And I could just go on and on naming people, which is a bad thing to do, but people I still think of very, very fondly. And there was this sense that we're inventing a better model of graduate education here. And that was just really exciting. I think I also look back, and I don't think the Preparing Future Faculty project nationally, while it's very important, I don't think it's had as big of an impact as I would have expected and hoped.
I was going to ask you what your
point in time. You know, I still hear people say, I had no training in teaching or pedagogy or understanding students or undergraduate education. I just was thrown to the wolves.
Yep.
And in what other profession in the world do we say it's not surgery, it's not dentistry, it's not accounting? You say, good luck, you know, just go try it, go and experiment on these other human beings.
Yep.
And it's such a bad model. But I think Syracuse has earned a leadership position in doing this well and faithfully for 3 decades. I just wish that movement were to, I think it is still to catch a blaze in the way that I think it needs to. Would you agree?
Yeah. You know, it's hard for me to say because I came, it was obviously, you know, such a well-established program by the time I became involved with it. So I didn't really know that much about the history of it. Obviously, you know, part of the logic is exactly what you said, that there's this huge skill deficit and knowledge deficit in this very important domain of being a faculty member, the teaching role, especially, you know, if you're a PhD student, you're probably in an R1 or otherwise research intensive kind of setting, you know, by definition. And that's kind of, everybody understands that that's the side where the bread is buttered. So there was definitely a role for that to play in terms of, you know, how much impact has the Preparing Future Faculty and similar efforts had nationally. That's a little bit difficult for me to say because I kind of came in midstream. But I think you would be pleased, Leo, that a lot of those components of that program that you talked about, the teaching mentors, the FPP conference, a lot of that experience is still very much the same and in place. That the effort originally, Syracuse was one of, I think, 16 institutions that got that FIPSA and Pew Charitable Trust money to become kind of a hub. For the idea was that you would have these PhD granting hub institutions and then these relationships with other kinds of institutions regionally where there would be an exchange and the graduate students would get a chance to teach at those other kinds of institutions, i.e. the kinds of institutions where they're much more likely to actually get a job than a place like these doctoral granting R1 schools. And in return, the faculty at those other institutions got a chance to mentor graduate students. So it was kind of this reciprocal relationship. But
Elon has been in that partnership.
That kind of depended on some of that grant money being in place to make that work. So once that was gone, it sort of shifted away from that model. There's not a lot of that aspect of it still in place. But the rest of it, in terms of the preparation for teaching, the certificate in university teaching, and also I see it as a great way to develop institutional awareness and awareness of higher ed as a business, as a sector, and kind of, you know, how it works, not just the limited perspective of your faculty role, to help students kind of understand, you know, where's their fit within higher ed, if indeed they choose to go in that direction. You know, it's a varied landscape, and you got to know yourself and your values and where you're going to be comfortable and be able to be your best self as a faculty member. So that's what I see as kind of the ongoing contribution that the FPP can make campus wide.
Yeah, I think that is true. I think it is also more acceptable for students at places like Duke and Syracuse, for graduate students to say, I don't envision my career at an R1. I want to be at a place where, yes, I will continue to do scholarship, but at Elon, 50% of your promotion and tenure decision is going to be based on true excellence in teaching. So we are looking at that in a primary way We have a statement. It's called the Elon Teacher Scholar Mentor Model of Faculty Work. And I might talk about it a little bit when I come up to Syracuse next month. And so we're intentionally looking for folks who don't want a job at a place like Elon as a fallback, but see this as a place to have a joyous career where they get to do really cutting edge and experience and experimental work in teaching, and also be supported in their scholarly endeavors as well. And also to be the place that blurs that line, that brings undergraduate students into their scholarship, you know, which supports, say, a robust undergraduate research program. One last recollection. I talk to my graduate students these days about a lesson I learned, a leadership lesson I learned in implementing the future professoriate program. And that is Leo's rule of thirds, which is, I think when you're proposing an idea like that, that is kind of countercultural initially, a third of the departments on campus are going to say, this is enthusiastic. A third, maybe a little bit more wait and see.
Yeah.
And a third, let's just say, not yet on board. And so that's so true in implementing any kind of innovation, that you start with the folks that are enthusiastic. And I think that's what we did, and quickly won over the rest. But it was that was one of the future professoriate program and its creation was one of the highlights of my career, and one of the things I look back on with great pride and satisfaction.
As well you should. Leo, time has just about passed us by, but I hope when you come on September 15th, I'm very interested to hear what your remarks will consist of. And I hope that your impression of the FPP kind of under my stewardship here kind of gives you some of that same sense that of pride and accomplishment that you were just talking about. I very much look forward to that. I hope we can get a good turnout for you for the FPP kickoff. I look forward to seeing you then. So thanks to you, and thanks to our listeners. This has been GradCast from Syracuse University.